Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, January 23rd. This morning, we talk state transportation funding as we take a closer look at its budget. What are its priorities and why? We hear from Met Opera star Quinn Kelsey, whose career has taken him across the world, and you can catch a performance at a theater near you this weekend. We also learn about a new movie theater opening up on the Friendly Isle, and a new surf film debuts tonight on Oahu. We talk to the photographer who's normally behind the camera, but for this, she is the star. And a plant sale teams up with a festival for Ohia. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Department of Transportation has a lion's share of the state budget. Today, HBR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us to talk about its ask for projects this year before the legislature. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yes, I know the DOT is also knee-deep into a harbor's modernization project and the airport's modernization project. But what else? What's up for highways?
So the Highways Department encompasses all of the state's road network. It's across all of our archipelago. And they have, as you said, a huge mandate and a massive budget that involves all the maintenance for these roads, as well as other forms of transportation that include bike pathways, pedestrian pathways, and alternative transit options. And one advocacy group, Hawaii Appleseed, would like to see the agency spend less on infrastructure that's focused for cars and more on infrastructure that supports other forms of transportation. So Hawaii Appleseed released this report late last year called Rethinking Roads, and in it, they analyzed the Transportation Department's spending between fiscal year 2019 and 2024, and they sorted projects into three buckets. Things that increase vehicle capacity, like adding lanes on highways, neutral projects on things like stormwater drainage off of highways, and then finally projects that support transportation alternatives like bike lanes and sidewalks. And their analysis found that about two-thirds of the agency's budget over that time went to projects that increase vehicle capacity, while less than 2% went towards projects that support alternative forms of transportation. And Abby Seitz, one of the authors of the paper, says that this is an issue.
We see a really big disparity in the amount of money going towards infrastructure that supports cars and supports people driving versus the type of infrastructure that supports folks who may not have access to a car or may not be able to use a vehicle in helping them get around.
And so did this report, consider rail?
It did consider rail, but what it was really looking at was trying to identify programs that were where there was dedicated funding that was going towards alternatives, so bike pathways, pedestrian walkways, such of that thing. And so that's why that number, 2%, is so small. And when I talked to Ed Sniffen about the analysis, he said he didn't agree with the central finding of Hawaii Appleseed's report. He thinks that Hawaii Appleseed's assessment of what kinds of projects increase vehicle capacity is too broad.
They considered anything that touched a road that didn't call out specifically a bike or a pedestrian path or a transit project as capacity building. I mean, they took out the neutral projects that they said was stormwater and the like, but anything that touched a road otherwise was a capacity project for them.
So he thinks that closer to 21% of the department's projects should be considered capacity building specifically for vehicles. And he says that some of that work that they're doing is going to reduce the amount of time people are spending in their cars on the long run. So when you look at Oahu's land use, he says it's such that jobs are concentrated in downtown Honolulu, but many people don't have the resources to live in that community, so they commute to work from other parts of the island. And Sniffen says the department is trying to build out infrastructure to incentivize business on other parts of the island.
Some of our projects that were lined out as capacity increases are access increases. We built out the Kapolei Interchange project into Kapolei and Kalaeloa to make sure that we could incentivize more businesses to build in that area. More businesses there mean more jobs there. There's more jobs there. Those that are living on the Leeward Coast that are driving 24 miles per day into and out of town and back out of town for another 24, driving that hour and a half in congestion and in backed up traffic, can now choose to live, to work closer to town, can choose to buy their goods and services closer to where they work to ensure that we can minimize the amount that they drive. So although there were lane increases that give us more access into Kalaeloa and Kapolei, there are long-term investments to ensure that we minimize VMT when we start increasing populations in those areas.
That's true, right? Because they are increasing housing in a lot of those areas.
Absolutely. And Stephen also points out that a lot of the department's budget simply go towards maintenance to keep roads safe. So when our transportation system was first designed in the 1960s, it was meant to handle 60 to 90,000 vehicles across all of the island. Now, Sniffen says, the roads are seeing 270,000 cars each day on different corridors. And so that comes with a lot of wear and tear. And they don't really have flexibility to take that spending and put it towards new projects. They have to keep these roads safe. So I brought these critiques back to sites with Hawaii Appleseed, and she says that she understands that safety is a priority, but they would really like to see the department place more of an emphasis on transportation alternatives, especially those dedicated ones for people who are not getting in their cars in some capacity.
Did she say, like, what types, what programs specifically?
Well, one that's come up is the Safe Routes to School program, which puts more money into making safe ways for kids to get to school by bike or on foot. And that program was actually dismantled during the pandemic, but lawmakers have revived it, and there is some funding set aside for it. And this year, the Department of Transportation is asking the state to release more than $13 million associated with that program, but sites said she would like to see a much bigger investment.
Ultimately, we'd like a lot of, you know, discussion, not only around how we can we have dedicated funding specifically for the Safe Routes to School Fund, but how can we just, you know, in general, be shifting away from kind of having roadway users who are not drivers, transit users, pedestrians, bicyclists, like how can they not be an afterthought in our budgeting process and in our overall kind of conversations around transportation?
And Sniffen, for his part, said that he would love for the agency to fund more projects that support pedestrians and bicyclists. And they do have $57 million put aside in this upcoming biennium budget for new bike paths and walkways. But he said even more money would help to propel that effort.
Absolutely. If we could get another $50 million per year, we could really start tackling a lot of the projects that are shown in our bike plan refresh, in our pedestrian master plan that we put together with input from the state 2 years ago. We've already aligned out prioritized projects in those areas, and we want to make sure that we can start moving forward on them.
Yeah, I mean, there's been lots of talk about improving bike safety, you know, throughout the state, but we're only seeing, you know, certain things happen, you know, just in recent years.
And Sniffen doesn't want to levy additional fees on road users or take away money from other agencies' budgets. And the Department of Transportation, as well as many of our other state agencies, does get a significant amount of money in federal dollars that is now somewhat in question under the new administration. When I asked Ed Sniffen about this, he says that they are in conversations about it. They're not sure exactly what the next 4 years will bring. Our Senator Brian Schatz, in one of the hearings for the nominee to lead the Federal Department of Transportation, did get confirmation that the pipeline for funding from the Infrastructure and Jobs Act would continue. So that is promising, but that's still something that the department is sorting out both on the state and different county levels. Something else to keep an eye out for, Department of Transportation is preparing a greenhouse gas reduction plan. So that's one of the settlement terms of the Nawahine lawsuit that was settled last summer, and that's supposed to be out in May. And apparently it's going to set additional targets for transportation alternatives, including what Ed Sniffen described as some sort of continuous statewide system of bike paths and walkways for pedestrians, and that's supposed to be completed over the next 5 years.
Yeah, lots of items on the wish list for the advocacy groups. We'll see how this plays out. But, you know, obviously you do see the need for repairing our highways, our roads and highways, because a lot of them are not in good shape.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HPR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Of Jose Fajardo, HPR's former president and general manager, invites you to make a donation in his memory to the HPR Jose Fajardo Student Internship Fund. The fund will help introduce local students to career opportunities in public media. To contribute to the fund, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/intern.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna with supportive housing, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
This weekend, you can lose yourself in a Metropolitan Opera at select theaters across Hawaii. Aida will be streamed from New York, and the production will feature Hawaii's Quinn Kelsey. His performance has been praised in recent reviews. Kelsey has been quite busy this season, as he was also in the Met's Rigoletto and Tosca. One of our producers caught his performance in Tosca last month and shared that Kelsey plays a wonderful villain. We got to talk to Quinn Kelsey this morning and asked what he enjoys about the character he plays in Aida.
So the biggest thing is that all of my other characters, or at least a huge majority of them, are the type where they come into the story with a specific trajectory, but then at one point, for whatever reason, they come to a crossroads, they end up changing their demeanor, or they end up changing the focus of how they entered. And with Scarpia, he's got one direction, he's got one idea in his head, or at least one general character focus, and that's it. He's just the bad guy, and he is the bad guy until his bitter end. And in a lot of ways, it just makes that kind of character a lot easier, because I don't ever have to worry about, not that I ever do worry, but that I don't have to come to that crossroads in the character and change direction at all dramatically. And it's not that that's a difficult thing to do. I actually really enjoy it, because it's a nice challenge in the process of the storytelling. But in a great long while, it's nice to be able to switch gears with a character like Scarpia and to not have to really think so much about the character development. I mean, Scarpia is a very complex character on his own, but in that way, a lot simpler.
Well, do you enjoy playing bad characters?
Definitely, you know, because I am not that type of person in real life. And so it's nice to be able to give all of my thought processes to this personality that is so contradictory to my own. Whereas there are other characters that I feel do more align with my own personality, then that takes more thought, in my opinion, because, you know, okay, it's kind of like me, so I'm going to put a lot of me into it. But then there are these other things that I have to layer on top. But for Scarpia, because it's such a contradiction that I can just generally do a 180 to who I am, and in a way that's already taken care of a good amount of what I would perceive a villain, you know, a straight villain to be like.
Well, you know, it's terrific that the Met has this cinema initiative to be able to try and reach new audiences. You know, we do have the Hawaii Opera Theater here. And, oh, by the way, while I think of it, a friend invited me this weekend to a fundraiser. And lo and behold, your sister was one of the stars. So I got to meet your sister. Mm-hmm. It was a delightful program. You know, it was opera, Hapa'ali Hula, Blue Hawaii was the name of the show. And it was just delightful. But, you know, there were two young girls in the audience, and they were just having the best time. And I think to have events like these where you can get people excited, you know, about, you know, the classics and find that spark, it's terrific.
Yeah, most definitely. This is one of the performing arts' biggest obstacles, is continually reaching out to the younger generation to make sure that as time passes, we continue to have some sort of a steady stream of new audiences, you know, new people who appreciate the performing art, classical singing, opera. So this is one of the biggest continuing initiatives that performing arts organizations are always involved in. Blythe joined HOT back in 2013 in education, and I heard stories about going to this school and doing this project and doing this other project for school students in general, and in a lot of ways it's just never ending. So I'm at the point now where I realize that part of my responsibility is to help that initiative so that performing arts can look forward to new audiences, new patrons in the arts as we all get older.
Well, it was really nice because the folks that I was with, they came to support the other gal that was also the star of the show, Leslie Goldman, and they had mentioned that they knew her when she was, you know, like 11, 12 years old. And it was extra delightful to see those young children there across, you know, the table having just, you know, a great time. And, you know, salute to your parents for producing just wonderful children with great gifts to delight all of us with your music.
Just to know that we are reaching such a wide audience besides just in the house at the Metropolitan Opera. I mean, I've been to different parts of Germany, Austria, Italy, the UK, and in all these places I've seen at movie theaters, you know, you've got some time off and there's a movie theater with original language showings, i.e. in English, you know, just to catch an actual movie when you have time off. And I almost always see the ads at the movie theaters for the Met HD broadcast. So the Met's reach through this program is pretty broad. I mean, obviously, I'm so pleased that Regal Cinemas in Hawaii does that as well.
Well, and it's so nice, you know, that we have you on stage, you know, so that your peeps back here can enjoy your performances, you know, because some of us don't get to New York as often as we would like. And so this is really a delight. And people can make an event of it, right? They can dress up and go to the theater and watch a Met performance and eat popcorn, too.
Of course.
Your sister mentioned that you will probably be coming home on your way to do another performance in Japan.
Yep. I live in Toronto now. I've had a place in Chicago for 21 years when I left Hawaii to study as a young artist in Chicago. Now that I have a soon-to-be two-year-old, she and her mommy are Canadian. And so my unofficial base is Toronto, and mommy has never been to Japan, so we're all going to go together. I'm doing La Traviata with the Seiji Ozawa Music Academy for a month at the end of February, and obviously Hawaii is on the way, so we're going to come up to Hawaii for just over a week just to break up the travel and then go to Japan for a month, and then we'd stop off on the way back as well.
I do have to ask you, we did have another singer in our studio, the tenor from Tonga, Ta'u Papua, and I know his story is that he took a job when he was doing the transition as an NFL player to opera at a restaurant, just so he could see what opera singers ate and drank. And so I have to ask, when you come home to Hawaii, do you just, you know, take it easy and, you know, can you eat kimchi and throw back a beer? I always wondered how that all works.
In my opinion, this is part of the opera singer's training, is to really know yourself, to know to know your limits, to know your strengths, to know your weaknesses. As young artists, we always hear the stories about singers who will lock themselves in their hotels or their apartments or whatever on the day of a show, and they won't talk all day so they can save their energy. Or the singers who, you know, will go out and work out at the gym an hour on the day of the show to get their energy up. I mean, everybody's different, you know. Some singers will only eat certain things on the day of a show because of how it builds up phlegm and extra mucus in their system, which is valid enough. Some people who won't drink alcohol or won't drink any carbonated things before going on stage, things like that. But I don't really have that problem, so I'm immediately looking forward to Hawaiian food and zippies and poke and plate lunch and all the things that I can't get really anywhere else but Hawaii. And that's kind of my plan.
All right. Okay. Well, we wish you safe travels. Break a leg with the show this weekend. And we hope to run into you at Zippy's when you're back home next month.
Yes, please.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for your time.
That was Hawaii's own opera star, Quinn Kelsey, who will be in the Met's production of Aida. The performance will be streamed at theaters across the globe, including here in the islands this Saturday at Regal Theaters on Maui, Oahu, and the island of Hawaii. Check local listings for times or head to our website for links later today.
The world takes you outside your borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble.
We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stay with you for a lifetime. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global news and inspiring voices that will keep you on top of the world.
Listen each weekday.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Ulupono Initiative, committed to sustainable and resilient Hawaii communities, investing and partnering in local food production, renewable energy, clean transportation, and freshwater resources. Ulupono.com.
You know, we are staying in the theater space with news that Molokai is eagerly awaiting the reopening, or I should say the opening, of a new movie theater on the island. Here to talk about that is HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what's the scoop on this new venue?
Pretty exciting news for Molokai. It's called the Mango Theater. It's located in Kanakakai. And it's the first theater on the island since 2008. And for those of us who feel like 2008 was just a couple years ago, it was 17 years ago that we had the last theater on Molokai. It's been under construction since 2018. And owner Brad Ellis says he stopped trying to make predictions about when it will open because of all these permitting delays, and it was delayed by the pandemic. But he says now he'd be surprised if it wasn't open by Valentine's Day. So that is right around the corner. It's a small space. The rest of the building is offices. There's one screen, but it has the whole works. There's popcorn, concessions with pizza, hot dogs. Of course, there's candy. There'll be even an app that will allow Molokai residents to order food and reserve their seat at the theater. Owner Brad Ellis gave me a tour of the theater, which is in the final stages of completion. Here he is.
So how many seats do we have here?
So we have 45. There's 40 regular movie theater seats. And then we have what we're calling our Ohana bench, which if you come back up here, you can see is not just a seat, but also has a table. So like a family can sit here, a family of five could sit here on this bench and put their food and drink up on that table. We've also designed this so that it's more than a movie theater. It can be a community gathering spot. So here we've put in a countertop with a sink and an under counter refrigerator so people can come in with a birthday party or a business meeting or something and set up their own food in the back.
Tell me about these chairs.
These chairs are, they're not the big reclining, you know, luxury chairs, but they are very comfy. Have a seat. And they're rockers, so they rock, very comfortable. We have them elevated on these platforms so that for sight lines, we did a lot of work trying to get the sight lines right. Seems to have worked out pretty well.
I love the idea of the Ohana bench, the picnic bench.
Yeah, it's a really fun spot in the back of the theater for all the cool kids to sit. And Ellis says he wants it to feel like any other theater you'd go to off island. You know, it's got all the bells and whistles. It's got, you know, the black paint and all of the padding for sound insulation, and it's a really beautiful space. He and his wife bought the building with no intention of starting a theater, but Molokai residents suggested it to him, and he says the response has been super enthusiastic. He says, you know, with all these delays, he's considered giving it up a few times over the course of the progress of construction and permitting and all of that. But the community, you know, continue to urge him on that this is something that they were really excited about and they really wanted to see in our community here.
Well, so
what kinds of... go ahead.
No, I was just wondering, you know, here on Oahu we have the chains, right? Consolidated, Regal. But how does that work? Because this is like an independent theater.
It is. So it's, you know, they own it. And he explains here in a minute how that all works and what kinds of movies will the theater show. Here he talks about it.
There's so much content out there now that we've missed out on here on Molokai, right? So we have lots and lots of stuff to choose from. But we're going to have first run movies. We're going to start off, we believe our first movie will be Moana 2. We had hoped it would have been a little bit more timely, but otherwise we're going to do a combination of first run movies and other movies that may have been out there for a year or two, but obviously haven't been seen on Molokai, and we'll pick up those as well. The way this works is we have a movie broker who actually goes out and gets the films for us, negotiates with the studios for whatever you negotiate, the length of how many days you have to actually have to run it, and all of those kinds of things. And so that's all, you know, taken care of. And then another company zaps the film here digitally over Wi-Fi hookup. Depending upon the length of the film, it takes 5 or 6 hours to download it. We'll set it up we'll have the, you know, the before movie stuff, ads, previews, you know, and that kind of thing. And then the movie will roll. Probably we'll start off with a 4-night-a-week, so we can get our feet on the ground and make sure we're doing it right. But I'm guessing that we'll eventually be a 7-night-a-week theater.
Gosh, I think the opening is going to be like the place to be on Molokai.
Right. So we're still awaiting the exact date. And he says that they do want to roll out this app so that people driving from the east end or driving from the west end of the island won't make it there and realize that it's sold out. So they want to roll that app out and get people used to it, I think shortly before it opens. But yeah, it's coming up really soon. He says, you know, they're in the final stages of getting, you know, electricity hooked up and just some final stuff. But there was, when I went, there was, you know, all the lights and the air conditioning, and it was really comfortable. And yeah, looking forward to it myself. So there used to be, believe it or not, 4 movie theaters on Molokai at the same time. And this was back in the 1950s and 60s. It's hard to believe now, you know, that we've gone so long without a movie theater at all. But most recently, the theater in Mauna Loa was run by Molokai Ranch, and that closed in 2008. Annette English grew up in Mauna Loa Town on Molokai's West End, and she shared stories with me about going to the movie theater there as a kid growing up in the 1960s.
Some of us couldn't afford, so we kind of snuck in. But then you get Mrs. Takasi and Mr. Takasi trying to find us, and we're hiding, you know. But I remember we were watching a movie, and you know how kids are. But it wasn't, I feel like when we get into trouble, it's not really bad, but it's like a fun trouble, yeah? So remember those Coke bottles? So we would drink it all, and we would sit at the top. And afterwards, when we drink it, then we roll it down. We roll it all the way down, so you bang, 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 you know? And then you get this older parents like screaming at us, like, what are you guys doing? So, and we kind of just duck down because it's all, it's not lighted, you know, it's all dark, yeah? And you know, at that time, like the sodas was like only 10 cents. And the coconut candy in the small little package, like 5 cents, 10 cents. Yeah.
And how much was a movie theater ticket?
25 cents. 25 cents. So we had they had the small little hold. You go over there, line up, pay your 25 cents. She will give you a ticket, and then you walk to the door, and you give the ticket, and then you walk in.
25 cents for a ticket. Oh my goodness.
I know, it's hard to believe it was just a different time. But even now, Brad Ellis is talking about the prices being pretty reasonable for the new theater. So it's looking like around $12 for adults, and there's a kupuna price, I think, of $10, and then $8 for keiki. So I don't know. It's been so long since I've been to a theater on Oahu, but I think it's a lot more than that normally.
Yes, a lot more.
So not too bad.
Oh gosh, yeah. Just I mean, I can't wait. I'm so happy for the community to have a venue like this again.
Yeah, I think, you know, everyone's saying it'll be a really positive thing for the island to give, you know, families something to do together, and just, you know, that positive vibe. Some evening activities for fun. So yeah. Looking forward to it for
yes.
sure.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for spotlighting this.
Thank you.
That was HPR reporter Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel with a story about a new movie theater opening on Molokai. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
What's it like having an active volcano towering over you?
It's really a completely multi-sensory experience. You know, you feel the throb through the ground. The sound is kind of reverberating up through your body as well as in your ears. And then there was stuff exploding out the top.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Volcanologist Tamsin Mather takes us inside mountains of fire and ash. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
A new documentary takes a look behind the camera, featuring the first female water photographer to shoot the prestigious big wave surf event, the Eddy at Waimea Bay. Krista Funk is an Oahu photographer who specializes in surfing and free diving. She is the star of the Red Bull documentary First In, Last Out. And ahead of its premiere tonight, the conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Funk about being a trailblazer in her field.
I actually started shooting in 2003. When I was 13 years old. And it all started because I had a teacher that noticed I was ahead in computer class. She loaned me her Canon EOS Elon II film camera. And I'd take it home and do assignments for her. And that built up to me being in photography classes in high school and then journalism newspaper. So I kept shooting. And then when I decided to go to the Coast Guard Academy, I kind of put shooting on the back burner. Like, it was there if I had time, but I felt like I rarely had time because I was so focused on being at school, taking all my classes and everything else that goes into it. I went to Coast Guard Academy and studied marine environmental science. And then competitive swimming fits into this whole mix. I started when I was 7 and I swam through Coast Guard Academy. I swam with their team for the 4 years. And after that, I was given my commission and assigned to Oahu. I was a deck watch officer on board Coast Guard Cutter Rush. It's a 378-foot boat that was out of Sand Island. And I did 2 years on board Rush. And then my next assignment was as a contingency planner for Sector Honolulu. And that was also out of Sand Island. And that was a 3-year job. But with all that being said and all the little pieces and parts, I feel like what I'm doing now kind of had this tumbleweed effect. I came out here and in my free time, I started surfing and body surfing. I wanted to be in the water every day and I saw an opportunity to do that. And it was amazing. I loved it. I started seeing guys in the water shooting and I went, oh, I've always wanted to shoot in the water. And I'd been picking up a camera again too. And that journey began.
And I mean, the way you're framing it, it's almost like you were like an amateur photographer, but you're very much not. Like, this documentary makes clear that you are one of the few women to shoot these big waves. So what do you think like set you apart or brought you to that next level?
I think it was the people in my life. And also it was due in part to me having a background in swimming, and my event was distance swimming. So having that foundation and then learning about the ocean and meeting people who knew what they were talking about with the ocean, like, and learning from others, it really helped a lot. And I have an obsessive personality. Like, once I get into something and I want to do it, I really dig in with it. That led me to clock hours and keep getting reps in. And I think that really helped me take what I had from photography from before and then seeking like how to improve my editing and moving that forward. Like, I think it all just flowed into where I'm at now. And it was why it was so fast, was because I had the background and I had a really solid foundation. I just needed to learn about the ocean, because a pool and lap lanes are very different from the ocean.
And so how is the process of shooting surfing similar to surfing itself? And in what ways is it different?
It's similar in the sense because you can't get every wave. It's more of the mindset that you're going to miss waves. You're going to be out of position. You're going to do something weird or something wrong. And when you're shooting, it's the same. Your camera can be out of focus. Some little thing is off. You're 10 feet out of position, or like outside or inside of where you want to be to capture a specific wave. Like, you're not going to get every single one. You're going to miss things. And so it's that I always find is so hard, because I just like, there's like, I call them the haunting shots. Like, amazing moments that I was just a little bit out of position for. Everything else was there, ready to go. I've had to learn to let go of those. So I would say that's probably the most challenging part with shooting. It's just, it's like a little Goldilocks game. Like, you have to be just right. Like, too much, too little, just right to really nail those shots.
When did Red Bull reach out to you about making this documentary, and how did they frame it?
So it was a combination of two things. One of the guys that I knew from shooting, his name is Connor Trimble. he asked if he could pitch me to different companies and just pitch my story. That process took time. Ended up being that I was shooting Red Bull Magnitude. It was a women's event that they ran for 3 seasons. And Connor came and shot me as I was shooting the paddle out circle. He created a whole pitch deck, sent it off to Red Bull, and then they accepted it. And I was so excited that Red Bull accepted it and they wanted to do anything on me. I was so grateful that Connor put in all the time to continuously like pitch my story because he thought it was worth telling. And it turned out, gosh, it took like 3 years. Not like 3 years. It took 3 years. But because of that timeline, there's footage of me shooting not this Eddie, but the last Eddie. And that was absolutely insane. Like, there's footage in there we wouldn't have gotten if we had a really quick turnaround and tight timeline. Also, towards the end, Bimarian Films got involved and they were the editors for the film. It was really fun to put together. It was hilarious too. Pipeline had had an amazing banner winter before we started filming. And we started filming and we could not buy a day for him to sit behind me as I was shooting and someone was inside of a wave. It was the most maddening thing because we'd had so many days before that. And it was just it was funny to me. We had a whole season where Pipe was pretty terrible and it was just not coming together for us. And we kept going, we're going to get one of those days. We're going to get them. And Connor and I were very persistent.
And you got the chance to shoot the Eddie again this past year. So what was that day like? And especially, were there any moments that you saw when you were in the water that the average viewer either on the beach or watching the live stream maybe didn't get to see?
It's an honor to be able to shoot the Eddie. And I can't believe there was a second one. So like, boom, boom, one right after the other. I was going, oh, I thought I was supposed to wait like 6 to 10 years at least. Oh, I was so thrilled and really grateful to the iCal family for letting me go on the water and document it again. What's crazy about Waimea is, and the hardest part about shooting it, trying to make it look as intense as it actually is. You can shoot a wave out there and have it look not crazy, and someone just had the most psycho vertical drop and made it. And you look at your picture and you're like, am I seeing that right now? So that's really challenging. And I think something I'd experience that you wouldn't feel if you're watching it yourself is just watching the wave rear up and lurch out and seeing that from the water, or swimming over a little bump and then going, oh, okay, that's at least 20 feet right there. Like, hi, you're here. Sometimes you can see it and you can definitely tell. And then other times they kind of just go, whoom, and you're going, okay, here I am. This is the spot that I'm in. I'm going to shoot. It's just such a wild feeling out there. And I can say you can hear the entire crowd cheering. And then when someone has a wipeout, you can hear them going, oh, like, it's just this energy pocket that comes into play when they run those events, because there's such a concentration of people in the area and then nature's showing off, and it's just amazing and unreal and all of the things that make shooting wonderful and being out there.
The way you talk about some of these waves is like they have personalities of their own. If you had to be like, oh, what's the personality of Jaws, or like, what's the personality at Waimea?
Oh yeah, they have personalities. Waimea's like, it's hard and fast. It's like quick, really scary drop, get down the face, and then it's done. But it's the most intense few seconds, like what the surfers are experiencing when they throw themselves over the ledge is just like a ball of like so many emotions. It's wild. Pipeline is Oh, she's a princess. She's so finicky. She's like the princess in the pea. If one little thing is off with her, she's like, I won't be that good. And it's just like, sorry the sun's not shining on you. Like, legitimately, it'll have like, the wave will have kind of some chop or won't be quite perfect before the sun comes out. But then, when the sun shines its beautiful rays on it, it goes, oh, I'm here. And that's pipeline.
Isn't that the case? You know, that was Krista Funk, a water photographer who is the star of a new Red Bull documentary. The film is titled First In, Last Out. It will premiere tonight at 7 p.m. at Waimea Valley with the free release online tomorrow. An annual festival celebrating all things ohia is pairing up with plant lovers on the Big Island for the first time. The East Hawaii Master Gardeners Program is helping to put on the Ohia Love Festival and Plant Sale this Sunday in Hilo. It will feature hundreds of native plants for sale, as well as fruit trees from Tropical Fruit Growers Network, Ulu from the Ulu Cooperative, and Home Hydroponics Kits. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Laura Reber, the coordinator for the East Hawaii Master Gardener Program, about how ohia awareness and a native plant sale go hand in hand.
The Master Gardener Program is part of the University of Hawaii at Manoa, College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resilience. The East Hawaii Master Gardener Program is just one. Every island has its own program, and the Big Island actually has two, one in West and one in East Hawaii. And we're here to provide the public with unbiased and research-based information about sustainable management practices. And this is geared at tropical gardening, you know, gardening in the tropics, our local landscapes, and it's for our community. Technically, it's an educational outreach program, and we've been around since 1982. And we're part of a nationwide program. So Master Gardeners is nationwide, also in Canada. It started in 1972. There's over 100,000 volunteers throughout the United States.
This year, you've partnered with the Ohia Love Fest, which is an annual festival. Talk a little bit about the decision behind that partnership and what each of you are bringing to this plant sale and festival.
I happened to be talking with Charlotte Godfrey Romo, who is an outreach specialist with Rapid Ohia Death. And she works under Dr. J.B. Friday, our forest extension agent. She was hearing about our plant sale that the Master Gardeners were working on. And she was like, well, these are a whole bunch of plant people. And how awesome would it be if we were able to collaborate and bring in the information about ohia and rod, but also the other amazing information exhibitors that come out for Ohia Love Fest to these plant enthusiasts. And so we'll have over 30 different exhibitors in the upstairs of our complex talking about ohia prevention and also like the surveying of ohia and rapid ohia death. And really, we kind of just wanted to showcase that Komohana Research and Extension Center is a community. We're a community center. We thought that if we brought this together, we would have all these plant enthusiasts and all this information all in one place. Plant enthusiasts come out to plant sales. That's just something well known. Big Island is really, really supportive of our plant sales. And so to be able to get that extra level of recognition for the ohia, I think is really the base of this partnership.
Yeah, we just highlighted the Grow Aloha program on our show and just another way to get native plants in your home. But I'm wondering, with individual gardeners taking them home, why is that important and how could that better help people understand the importance of native plants and to grow them themselves?
That's a really good question. And I will share that in the last 2 years of our plant sale, having more native plants available was one of our biggest asks of our community. And so we have worked really hard to provide more native plants. It's the biggest category of our sale. And I think it's because if we don't take the time to plant them and have them in our yards and have them available, they're not going to be here in the future. And I think that's one of the most extremely important. It's also really hard to propagate native plants. And so master gardeners have taken the time to propagate them out and to learn propagation techniques. And we have a native garden that was planted maybe 12 years ago that the last year and a half we've been rejuvenating. And so we're going to have tours of those native gardens so that way people can see these plants that they can buy at the plant sale, what they can look like in their yards here in East Hawaii, and just to make those connections.
And so maybe a little bit more on the festival. So what will that entail and what people can expect?
The sale and the Ohia Fest start at 10 a.m. on the last Sunday, the Sunday coming up, the 26th. And community members can expect to have Big Island Invasive Species Council is having a plant up ohia, so they can learn actually how to tend and plant ohia at one of our booths. There's ohia five things in which it talks all about prevention and spreading, and then people can ask questions. There's a lot of people going to be here that are extremely knowledgeable about ohia, and so therefore, if community members have these questions, there's somebody to answer them. And the four stewards are also going to be here. And they're like master gardeners, but for forest. And so they're extremely enthusiastic. And so the conversation can be engaged and then had, and then hopefully can spread more awareness, but then also more planting of ohia. And there's also going to be the Forest Service who will be able to answer questions regarding, like, you know, how the ohia is doing within our forest in general. Really, they can just expect a magnitude of different types of information coming out.
Anything else that you want to share with listeners? You mentioned that one underutilized resource of the program might be the plant hotline.
Sure. So master gardeners are trained for 14 weeks. And then after that 14 weeks of training, they have to do over 40 hours of community service. And 18 of those hours are on our helpline, and that's a minimum. And so our helpline runs every Friday from 9 to noon at Komohana Extension Center. And people can either email, call, or walk in, and they can ask us any question about gardening, whether it be, what is this plant? What is this insect? How do I plant this? What should I plant? And there's different master gardeners that come in every week. And I feel like it's almost an underutilized service. And yet master gardeners are eager to help. And so if you do have plant questions, you know, what would grow well in my yard? How do I take care of something? Please feel free to reach out. The number for the helpline is 808-969-8203. And then again, you can always just Google East Hawaii Master Gardener Helpline and you'll get all of our information.
That was Laura Reber, the East Hawaii Master Gardener Coordinator, talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. The annual Ohia Love Festival will take place this Sunday from 10 to 2 at the Komohana Research and Extension Center complex in Hilo. We will have links to more information on the conversation page of our website after the show. That's all we have time for today. Up tomorrow, we talk about our fire department's history and mark the 125th anniversary of the Chinatown fires. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere you tune in for podcasts or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.